From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Mind Over Matter. Here's what's happening. Well, was it a supersonic aircraft, a meteor, a ground explosion? Those are some of the questions experts and non-experts around the world are asking themselves right now in recent weeks as well. As curiously, loud mystery booms continue all around the country, shaking buildings, rattling nerves from Alabama to Michigan, Idaho to California, Russia to Denmark. The Alabama boom last Tuesday was heard and felt through 11 counties, but an earthquake event has been ruled out. They just don't know what it is right now. Very strange. President Donald Trump and the latest demonstration of increased tensions on the Korean Peninsula has now placed North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, what's the latest on this one?
Well, this should come as no surprise to anyone. You know, they were taken off the list in 2008 by George W. Bush as an act of good faith in hoping Kim would disarm and stop his ballistic missile and nuke program. We know how that worked out, but it's really remarkable when you think, George, back to January 29, 2002, when Bush identified North Korea as part of the axis of evil along with Iraq and Iran. Now, he got it wrong with Iraq, but it certainly didn't get it wrong with North Korea. They do have weapons of mass destruction, and they're showing that they would use them if they have the if and when they have the opportunity, especially with a nuke-tipped ICBM. But I think Trump's designation is more to ratchet up the pressure on them, more diplomacy, trying to get the Kim regime to the negotiating table, because the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, that is, disarming Kim from his nukes and ballistic missiles, is the goal of this administration, not simply to kick the can down the road.
John, and let me ask you this situation, because we've been talking about this for months now. Do you really believe we're going to have some military conflict, whether it's armed soldiers or just missiles?
No, I do think that that they're playing out the diplomacy card right now to the nth degree. Trump and Rex Tillerson, and Tillerson reinstated today in a White House press conference, that the goal of the administration is to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula and through diplomacy. But if diplomacy fails, they've made it very clear that North Korea is going to face the full force of the U.S. military.
All right, John. John's website, onlinecolumnist.com, he puts out a great blog. David Cassidy, said to be in very critical condition, the singer hospitalized with organ failure. David's publicist has confirmed that the former Partridge Family star, suffering from severe kidney failure and desperately also needs a liver transplant. Della Reese, touched by an angel star and singer, dead at the age of 86. Della Reese, a performer, pastor, best known for her starring role on CBS's spiritual drama Touched by an Angel, has died at the age of 86. Reese, who was born Della Reese, Patricia Early in Detroit, started singing in church when she was 6 years old. She told NPR back in 2003 that she was recruited by gospel legend Mahalia Jackson to tour with her at the age of 12. She was a great actress, great singer. Della Reese, dead at the age of 86. And here's somebody who is burning in hell as I speak, Charles Manson, the 60s cult leader behind one of the most notorious killings in American history, is dead. He died Sunday in California after a prolonged illness. He was 83 years old. Manson, who infamously wore a swastika tattoo between his eyebrows, had spent more than 45 years in prison after being convicted of directing his Manson family clan of troubled, mostly female followers to kill 7 people in California in the summer of 1969. The dead included actress Sharon Tate, the pregnant wife at the time of director Roman Polanski, and she was stabbed 16 times. Charles Manson dead at the age of 83. Argentina's Navy says its submarine, which has been missing since Wednesday, reported a mechanical breakdown in its last communication. The submarine with 44 crew on board disappeared off the Argentine coast and has no trace been found. A NASA astronaut's wristwatch worn aboard an Apollo mission in 1968, before we went to the moon, has been returned to the Smithsonian nearly three decades after it was stolen from a museum in Ecuador. The Omega Speedmaster professional watch, which astronaut Don Eisel was issued to wear on board the Apollo 7 mission, don't forget Apollo 11 landed on the moon, of course, and it was just dramatic. But in this case, somebody stole the watch. The watch was recovered with the help of space history enthusiasts who provided the authorities with information about the watch's status and location. Now, get this. More than a half a million people applied to become citizens of Asgardia, the first space nation that will orbit the Earth and be free from politics and laws. The idea came from a billionaire Russian computer scientist who has already confirmed the first 200,000 citizens from the initial 500,000 applicants. Earlier this week, the satellite was launched. Robert Zimmerman, our space historian and science advisor, is this going to happen?
Well, they've got that first CubeSat tiny satellite. All it has is like a lot of pictures on it. Launched on the Cygnus freighter that went up to ISS last week. And sometime in December, they will release it from ISS, and it'll be in orbit for a short period of time. This is one of those silly, scam might be too harsh, but I don't know how seriously you can take this. At some point, the guy in charge of this is going to, I'm sure, turn around and try to monetize the list of names he's got and the information he's got. And he doesn't need to get much from each one of them to make some money from it, but I don't know what else he can do with it. You can't have a nation. First of all, they can't claim any territory in space. Where are they going to get the money to launch satellites down the road? How are they going to launch even a space station down the road? If they do raise money, well, you know, there are plenty of private companies in the United States that would be glad to sell them the space station to build, and that would be profit and money. And, you know, then they'd be a customer.
How long would you like to stay out in space, Robert, if you went up there?
Well, that's interesting. You know, what I would like to see is the ability to fly to space become as cheap and as available as airlines. And that took about a half a century in the 20th century to reach that point, from, you know, the Wright brothers to jets that anyone could just buy a ticket on. And that's what I'd like us to see. Once that starts happening, then suddenly, if I want to go to space, I'm just going to buy a ticket and I'm going to go, and there'd be a colony there that I could then visit and go sightseeing.
What's new with your website, BehindTheBlack.com?
Well, the most interesting thing is, George, I just published a science fiction novel. Which is something I'd written in 82 and is still pretty undated. It's actually a pretty good book, called Pioneer, and posted on my webpage. People can get it on Amazon anywhere they want. But what's interesting about it is that it parallels this story that just showed up of an interstellar asteroid object that has flown through the solar system. The story I wrote has to do with the discovery of the body of an astronaut that disappeared almost a half a century earlier on an asteroid that was beyond Jupiter, and they find his body on Mars. It's set about 200 years in the future. How did he get from that asteroid to Mars is the question, and with his remains was the remain of a robot hand, an alien robot hand. And so aliens, asteroids, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Sounds like
the
movie. Sounds like a movie. Robert, thank you so much. NASA has once again been accused of covering up the existence of alien life after an astronaut apparently captured footage of something unknown. The mysterious object was spotted entering Earth's atmosphere by one of the crew of the International Space Station, despite assurances from the space agency that it was just a meteor. Conspiracy theorists remain convinced it was evidence of extraterrestrials. What else is up there in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Doc, what's up?
Well, George, so many wonderful things, but if you go around the internet, folks, you'll find that the term fireball is trending just about everywhere, George. As you mentioned, some believe what was seen by the astronaut in the ISS may indeed have been otherworldly, but many believe it might have been a large fireball. But here we go, right here in Phoenix, as we know, and all throughout the nation, George, and around the world, people are seeing an unprecedented number of these fireballs, and here's probably the skinny. We're going through right now no less than 5 meteor streams. They're all going on right now. They do this every year, but it seems like we're just, for some unknown reason, picking up so many more of these bright fireballs. So Dr. Sky's recommendation is simply this. While the moon is still not bright, you still have opportunities in the early evening and all through the dark of the night, of course, to watch and pan the skies. People are seeing amazing things, George, and I don't know if any of these are striking the Earth, but it's a great time to look. If we go 11 light years out into the universe, George, the possible best candidate for a potentially habitable exoplanet we now know is the star system called Ross 128. Around this little red dwarf, George, there appears to be this little tiny planetary object, probably a little bit smaller, a little bit larger, I should say, than the Earth. And what makes this even more interesting, astronomers in South America, the large telescopes and radio telescopes in Puerto Rico, actually detected a weird signal coming out from that particular star system. So who knows, George, that may be some place where intelligent life, of all the places we look, might be the best place. But in the live sky, you have the moon waxing, George. It means it's getting brighter each evening. Tomorrow and then on to Wednesday, the moon, Mercury, and Saturn all appear in the sky just after sunset. First quarter moon on the 26th. But George, as always, as I mentioned, any questions or comments, email me at just drsky@cox.net. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies, of course. But George, the simplest and best thing I could say, happy Thanksgiving to you, the staff, and the entire listening audience.
You too, Dr. Sky. And thank you for bringing us just great, exciting astronomical reports. Really appreciate it. 70th anniversary of the Central Intelligence Agency. Up next, the Ghosts of Langley on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. As I was mentioning, 70th anniversary of the CIA. And our special guest tonight, John Prados, is the author and analyst of the National Security Based Washington, D.C. He is the author of about 30-plus books, many articles on topics of current importance, presidential studies, military history, including Vietnam, the Soviet Union, World War II as well. He is a noted designer of board games on military strategy. And, of course, his book is called The Ghosts of Langley. Fascinating work, John. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you've developed board games on military strategy. Tell me you invented the game Stratego.
No, not Stratego, but my big game is probably called Third Reich. It's
I've heard of that.
See, there you go. 500,000 copies that game did.
How did you get involved doing that?
Well, it was all because of cardboard. How about that? when I was a kid, there were these board games. I ran into them when my mother took me to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and they were selling games in the museum store. And we got a couple of them, and I really got into these things. And then it turned out that this company, it made maybe 2 new games in a year. And it advertised by mail and for months and months ahead of time before it had a game, you would be getting advertisements for that thing. Well, anyway, their games cost more than my allowance. You know, I had to work a month to afford one of these games. So I started out looking at their advertising, and when they would say something was coming up, I would go, oh, that's interesting, and I'd make my own version of it.
I love it.
And then when their game actually came out, you know, somebody I knew was bound to get this game, so I could compare what they did with what I had done. And that's how I taught myself to do these things.
But, and you're a very prolific author. You've written a number of books on just the CIA alone. It's hard to believe 70 years since it was formed. 70 years.
Well, that's true, isn't it? But look at how long the Cold War went on, and that was the big Cold War agency. And then since the Cold War, there's certainly not been much of a call to take down the CIA, although that may yet happen at any moment, you know.
Well, and we're going to come back to this, but John Kennedy tried to chop it up in some form or fashion, and I'm just wondering if that might have contributed to what happened to him.
Well, I make an argument, and I didn't put this in the Ghost of Langley book, but the argument is there to be made that on a certain level, John Kennedy is a ghost of Langley because of the sort of enthusiasm, if that's the right word, that he had about going after Castro,
mm-hmm.
and the degree to which people think that maybe the Cubans were getting back at Kennedy. I will say one of the interesting things in the new documents released from the Kennedy Assassination Records Board is the record that shows that just 10 days before he was assassinated in Dallas, Mr. Kennedy sat through an extensive briefing on the Cuba operation and approved the next targets that were going to be hit by the CIA.
That's fascinating. We'll come back to that, John. But let's talk about the CIA and its birth, the inception. How did that start?
World War II is ending. We have an intelligence organization. It's called the Office of Strategic Services. High people in the OSS, people like Wild Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles, want America to have a peacetime intelligence agency. The country is also coming out of a war which started at Pearl Harbor, and one of the big arguments about Pearl Harbor is that America was taken by surprise, in theory, because it didn't have an intelligence agency.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Truman, who was the president of the time, arranged that there would be a scaled back, sleeker, slipped down intelligence function that was separated out, part to the military, part to the State Department. And he organized something that he called the National Intelligence Authority. That was this kind of a managerial thing, sort of like what we have today with the Director of National Intelligence. But there was no intelligence agency proper. And there were dreamers out there like Alan Dulles who dreamed of the peacetime intelligence agency and agitated for it. So there was a ready support group, shall we say, to go for this kind of an entity in the U.S. government. And as the months went on after the war had ended, their appeals became stronger, and then the assets and the resources of these smaller stripped down groups that were in the military and in the State Department were so tightly strung out that it became evident that they needed more. Now, one of the big political issues, if you will, at the time was the whole idea of unification of the armed forces, a peacetime draft, and creation of a new concept, really a theoretical concept called national security.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this got balled together as what was called the National Security Act of 1947. And the activists who were dreaming of the peacetime intelligence agency hitched their wagon to that star and got their intelligence agency included in that legislation. So the 1947 Act actually created a whole slew of things, the Central Intelligence Agency being among them, but also the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, the Marine Corps recognized as a complete military entity, the Air Force as a separate military service, and the peacetime draft, all of those things in one law.
You know, as I was reading The Ghosts of Langley, I couldn't put down the fact that this is an agency cloaked in so much darkness, which, of course, is the subtitle of the book, Into the CIA's Heart of Darkness. We're going to talk more about this with you, John, when we come back. It's an amazing story, The Ghosts of Langley. We're going to be back in a moment with John Prados as we talk about his work, The Ghosts of Langley. It's about the CIA. It's an amazing story. We'll take phone calls with John next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our guest John Prados, his book, The Ghosts of Langley. George Norrie here with you in the cave in St. Louis for the holidays. John, let's get back in to talk about the CIA. There is that darkness surrounding the CIA, and I have always felt, John, and you know better than I, that the CIA, as strong as we need intelligence for this country, that they were doing their own thing and running their own show and profiting for themselves. What do you think of my feelings about that?
Well, we'll put the profit thing off to the side for the moment.
Okay.
But in my view, the agency has been engaged in activities that sort of skirt the boundaries of the acceptable. And every so often there's an explosion. And each time there's an explosion, the agency's being, state of being, is threatened. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, the protective reaction is to come up with one argument or another to save themselves. And then these arguments become part of the framework, and they get used and reused. To take an example, you mentioned a few minutes ago Jack Kennedy and the CIA at the Bay of Pigs. Well, at the Bay of Pigs, one of the things that agency officers did to protect themselves was to argue that the investigator, the inspector general who looked at what they had done, hadn't interviewed anybody. This actually was a phony argument because he'd interviewed more than 130 people.
Oh, my gosh.
But we'll put that aside for the moment. You fast forward a few decades, and there's the Senate torture report, and the CIA argues against the Senate torture report that the investigators didn't interview anybody. Well, lo and behold, if you look into that, it turns out that the day that the investigators arrived at Langley to interview people, they were physically blocked from going into the Inspector General's office by the CIA General Counsel. So the protective responses often get to the top, really, and over the top of what's acceptable. And this has to do with not only the inventory of arguments, but also the sorts of different kinds of characters that have made up this agency. Dreamers like Alan Dulles, who built a house that the CIA lived in. You know, zealots for whom accomplishing the job means forget the rules. Schemers who are trying to just maximize their power within the agency. And there are real stars, you know, people on the ground doing the job, getting things done, and sometimes their careers, their lives even, get cut short because of some of these things that are going on in other places, or because the job is simply something that isn't easily accomplished.
Who was asleep at the wheel during 9/11, John? Because
one of the CIA stars is a woman named Jennifer Matthews, who was actually among those people who were killed in Afghanistan in 2009 at Forward Operating Base Chapman. She's been named as a person of interest, let's say, in the 9/11 failure. And that...
Was she a scapegoat?
No, I don't think she was a scapegoat, and I'm not sure that she was as responsible as some people say. There are some other CIA officers more at the heart of it than she was. But the critical failure that the commission, the 9/11 commission, fastened on this business about building walls between agencies, that in the CIA's house was a case where the agency knew that certain people who turned out to be among the hijackers had entered the United States, and by not sharing that information with the FBI and the State Department, they made it impossible for FBI to follow those people. But, you know, the same thing happened on the FBI side, and in fact, including dealing with some of the same people, where they had spies, they had sources that were reporting on some people in the Muslim community, and they had wiretaps on some phones where some of these people turned up on, and they didn't tell the CIA. So there was plenty of responsibility to be shared in the 9/11 situation.
How would you rate the CIA to the old KGB or the Israelis Mossad or Savak in Iran? How would you compare it to that?
I would give CIA very high marks for its technological wizardry and ability to craft novel means of getting at information. I think the KGB was better at manipulating people and getting its way through sorts of personal plotting. Savak was a ham-handed kind of a secret police operation. They really were not very good on the intel side, but they were very good on security. And Mossad...
they're good.
Mossad was good. Small but good. In the same way that the British Special Intelligence Service was small but good. And the Mossad... probably was a major help for the CIA, because the Mossad had the facility and the ability to do some kinds of operations that the CIA had more trouble accomplishing.
You call the book The Ghosts of Langley. Tell us about the title.
The ghosts are... these people, these dreamers, the zealots and the schemers, the stars and the meteors. An organization like the Central Intelligence Agency, you know, it kind of takes on the character and the ethos of its high priests and its stars. And the organization also copies, I wouldn't say their careers, but the kinds of things that did in somebody that you really esteem, or the kinds of things that burnished the reputation of someone that you really esteem, those accomplishments and those disasters of the forebears in your organization become things that you want to copy and emulate, or contrary to the contrary, that you want to avoid. So in this sense, these classic characters in the agency become ghosts. And the ghosts give the example to people who come after them. A good example with which the book actually starts, is these two psychologists that the agency hired as consultants to the black prison and torture program, and they end up at the heart of this very, very controversial CIA activity. Now, today, a few years later, anyone who's asked to ever torture for the CIA, or in fact, anyone who's even asked to interrogate for the CIA, or all these higher-ups who are batting back and forth, the question of should we torture, shouldn't we torture, blah, blah, blah. all of these people have the example of what happened to those psychologists in front of them. Those psychologists' spirits are now inflicting and infecting CIA operations.
Some will say, John, that we are hated as a nation around the world because we meddle with every other country's affairs. What would you say to that?
I think that there's something in that. I mean, it's clear if you go back into CIA history that we have gone into Italy and France, for example, and executed operations to prevent standard political parties from exerting their political influence in the system that existed in their country. We played with elections in Chile on multiple occasions, in Peru. In Cuba, we supported a dictator who mouthed democracy and then went after his successor who overthrew him because he wasn't, in fact, a Democrat.
And by the way, John Kennedy, in his speeches prior to becoming president, supported the guerrillas in Cuba, basically saying that their ideology was correct. Did you know that?
That may be, yes, that's true.
And then he did his change when Castro changed. You know, Castro took over, and of course, that's another show all by itself. But back to the CIA, we had talked about it's for profit. And I have long suspected that something's behind the increase in poppies in Afghanistan. Well, the Taliban had it down to virtually nothing. And we go in there, and all of a sudden, the drugs are flowing again. I've got a couple guests, John, that have said that some military, U.S. military folks, are guarding these poppy fields.
You know, one of the problems with, we were talking a moment ago about political manipulations and whatnot. One of the problems with the great power, one of the problems with the superpower, is that it's acting in an environment in which people are, in fact, doing what they do to make a profit. And that the power itself in the institutions it uses, such as the CIA with its ghosts, you know, those are people who are tempted by the same things. So you talk about the drugs in Afghanistan. Yeah, the CIA was acting in Venezuela at a time when drugs were flowing through Venezuela. In the Southeast Asian War of the 1960s and 70s, there were plentiful reports out there that CIA and CIA proprietaries like Air America were smuggling drugs in the field over there. Now, I said earlier that I don't think that the agency is running this. It's not a mafia running this for profit, but it is composed of people who have their own angles to play. And that kind of stuff is going on in every one of these situations. Look at actually the CIA operation against Nicaragua in the 1980s. There was massive amounts of cocaine flowing through Central America at the same time. As a matter of fact, and this is now a Hollywood movie, you know, one of the things that we did to try and discredit the Nicaraguan government was to do a setup operation where we put drugs in an airplane and contrived to get them discovered and have the airplane related to senior officials of the Nicaraguan government.
Is the CIA to date, John, your opinion, out of control?
I think that this situation is highly complex. We have a president who is a shoot from the hip, kind of prejudged and very impatient character. Because of the torture situation, the torture controversy in which the agency, the CIA, needed to protect itself, it essentially cut off the congressional oversight committees in its attempt to suppress the torture report. The result of that was, number one, that the agency has the potential to be out of control. Number two, that the potential for those oversight committees to provide a safety net for the CIA is also gone. And here you have the CIA responding to arbitrary orders from this president. So there's a high probability that the agency will be told to do something very controversial, and there's a low probability that the agency can be protected when it gets caught doing that.
Why does it seem that every CIA director seemed to want to do the right thing, and they never did?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that I do with the ghost metaphor that is in The Ghosts of Langley is that I try and characterize some of the different CIA directors, like Alan Dulles was the dreamer. Well, in this schema, George Tenet was the exorcist. You know, he was the one who might have gotten rid of the ghosts by sort of reconditioning the CIA and repositioning it within the American cultural and political firmament. And he essentially was stopped from doing that by the rise of the terror war. 9/11 and what came afterwards,
right,
spelled the end for Tenet's attempt at reform. The directors that have followed him have been, in their efforts to be committed to the terror war, successively pounding against the limits that might have held back the CIA and kept it under discipline, if not under control. And so I have the Jacob Marley spirits, and I have John Brennan as the Flying Dutchman in this book.
Do we, at this point, need the CIA?
That's an interesting question. I mean, if we didn't have the CIA, we would, because of the terror war, need to have something like it. I've argued in other places, not here, that the proper way to have handled what's going on with the terrorist fighters is to treat that as a security and police matter, not as a war, a warfare kind of a matter. And if you were going to do that, you would need a police or a security organ. And so there's your role for something like the CIA.
John's book is called The Ghosts of Langley. His website is his name, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back next hour, we are going to take phone calls as we continue talking with him about the CIA's Heart of Darkness. That's the subtitle of the book, and boy, is that very poignant. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.